I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm sipping on right now while I record this podcast. No, it's not an iced mocha or a Diet Coke. It's Element, a sugar-free electrolyte drink mix that helps me stay hydrated all day long. As a business owner and a podcast host, it's easy to forget to drink water when I'm in back-to-back meetings. But each Element packet has the perfect blend of sodium, potassium, and magnesium, the perfect ingredients to quench your thirst. Right now, Element is offering a free sample pack with any purchase. That's 8 single-serving packets, a great way to find your favorite flavor. Their new chocolate mint, chocolate chai, and chocolate raspberry flavors are my favorite, and they are meant to be enjoyed hot. Get yours at drinkelement.com/girlboss. That's drinkelement.com/girlboss. Hello and welcome back to Girl Boss Radio. I'm your host, Avery. I'm the founder and CEO of Bloom, an HR and DEI consulting firm, and a big believer that work should work for all of us. Today, I'm joined by Liz, Girl Boss's general manager, to chat about today's guest, Christy Coulter. Christy is the author of Exit Interview, The Life and Death of My Ambitious Career, and I just finished reading this entire book while I was traveling through Iceland. It was a brutally honest memoir about her 12 years working at Amazon that were both exciting and rewarding, but also extremely disappointing at times. In 12 years, she'd never been promoted, and it was being dangled in front of her the entire time. When she asked what it would take for her to get promoted, the response she got was this: "That's easy. Just change the world." Liz, you listened and read the book too.
I actually did not listen to it. I read it. Her publishing team was kind enough to send us all copies of the book to read before the podcast. But in the meantime, while the hard copy was on its way, they gave us a PDF of the book. And I was so impatient for the hard copy that I read the PDF of this book on my phone at night, just zooming in, which was a terrible reading experience. I don't recommend it to anyone if you want to preserve your vision. But that's kind of how dialed in I was into this book from day one. I just couldn't put my phone down because that's where the book was. So I have the hard copy now, hilariously. It only came a few days ago, but it's good because now I have a loaner copy to give out to friends because I've talked to everyone about this book. It's been a long time since I've read something that I've so deeply connected to, because I felt like so many of my own inner thoughts and frustrations and ambitions were really reflected in Christy's story. As you said, Avery, she spent 12 years at Amazon in like a mid-senior role. I think she was at the level right below VP or something like that. And it took her a really long time to leave because the money was just so good, largely because her Amazon stock options were skyrocketing during that time in the mid-aughts. And I think it's also clear in the book, she didn't want to leave for a long time because her identity became so entwined with this company. And quitting would have probably been like a sign of defeat. It would be like admitting that she couldn't do it. She couldn't hack it in this like super high growth, competitive, super intense workplace. Eventually, she did leave, which is how she wrote the book. But towards the end of her tenure in 2015, Jodi Kantor was a reporter for the New York Times. She's also one of the reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story for the New York Times as well. She wrote a report called Inside Amazon: Wrestling Big Ideas in a Bruising Workplace. And it basically uncovered all the toxic work culture at Amazon. But then all of the higher ups, mostly men at Amazon, denied it in company channels and downplayed it and basically gaslit people, especially women at the company, to be like, no, these experiences are not valid. This is not true. That, and yet again, being passed up for a promotion for like the 8th time, that was finally what pushed her over the edge into quitting. Today, Christy's an author, so this is her second book, and she engages in conversations around sobriety. She actually quit drinking halfway through her time at Amazon, and also just explores what ambition looks like now to her and what other fellow disillusioned women can take from her story.
For me, the book really made me reflect on all the corporate experiences that I had prior to starting my own business. I worked for like probably 7 to 10 years in corporate environments prior to starting Bloom. And what a lot of people don't know is that I didn't ever like dream of being an entrepreneur or becoming a founder. I was forced into it. And this is an experience that a lot of racialized women have in traditional corporate workplaces, is they get pushed out of these environments because they weren't built to include us or to support us or where we can actually thrive. In fact, a lot of these environments are really harmful for us. And I had a really hard time actually resonating with and connecting to Christy's book in the first 3 to 4 chapters. I remember messaging you, Liz, being like, I'm having a hard time relating because this woman is so obviously white and so obviously privileged. And she's basically tolling over this amazing job opportunity that she has at Amazon and this great career that she has launching her into this space. And it seemed as though, even though she didn't have the most affirming workplace experience at Amazon, I always kept thinking throughout the book, how would this be for a Black woman?
That's a completely valid thing. And when I think about my own work frustrations, or if I had a bad day, or if I feel like my career is like existentially, I'm having a lot of questions or doubts, I always have to knock myself down a peg and be like, calm down. Like, oh my goodness, you're already so privileged. You're already so well set up for success. The opportunities you've been granted are so beyond a lot of people's wildest dreams. And all you have to do is just not screw it up royally. and you're fine. You're fine. In a backwards way, I did relate to the book because I've had the very same thoughts that Christy had. And the times I have failed to look outside my own experience and my own bubble to think about that, to think about how my struggle is someone else's dream scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, as I moved through the book, it only reaffirmed my opinion that I have just in general around any of the experiences that people have at work that may be the same as mine or different, is that whether you're drowning in 5 feet of water or 50 feet of water, you're still drowning. And it was horrifying to read these experiences that Christy and people around her had navigating through this 12-year career journey.
Yeah, at one point, Christy gets called stupid to her face by a very, very high up executive. We talk about that later in the episode. One woman, to try and make her feel better, said, well, don't worry, he probably wouldn't have talked to you that way if he didn't respect you. It means that you can take it. And so it was like, even when you're being insulted, you should try and see it as a compliment, because boys club.
Yeah, that made my skin crawl when I listened to that part of the book. Also, for me, this is where I actually was able to relate, because I think that whole strong Black woman trope, I think that a lot of white women in senior leadership roles that have made their way into these spaces, even in middle management, I think that they are almost assumed that they got there because they were able to take the brunt of this harsh, male dominant type of environment. So again, leading back to what you said, Liz, is that feedback of like, well, means that they think that you can take it, so you're deserving of this abuse, which is totally wildly inappropriate and not accurate.
Yeah, it's like you have to bend to the organization. The organization will never bend for you. And this is, again, something that Christy encounters over and over again at Amazon. And if you want the workplace to change and be more accepting of women, guess who has to do that work? It's women. It's minorities. And again, it's this perpetuating cycle of, well, everything's fine according to men, so everything will continue to be business as usual.
And Christy speaks about the weight that was lifted off of her shoulders when she no longer had to manage a large group of women, because she was carrying the burden of their own insecurities and also essentially the fallout of this toxic workplace experience that she wasn't necessarily responsible for or equipped to support these people with.
There's a quote that I love in the very early part of the book. This is where it cemented for me that, like, I'm going to like this book and I'm going to talk about it relentlessly to anybody who will listen. She's still interviewing for the position. It hasn't been offered to her yet at Amazon. So this is the quote. Here's how I got every single one of those jobs. I sat across a desk from a man old enough to be my father, and I enveloped both of us in a force field of earnest competence, the kind I'd been practicing since kindergarten with my hand permanently raised in class, the kind that says, I will die before I let you down. And at some point in each of those interviews, the man pronounced me impressive and gave me the job, and the prophecy came true. I never let him down. Yeah, I've been that girl. I've sat across those men and I have been deemed impressive. And this idea of I will die before I let you down is something that I am still navigating in my career currently. It's a big weight that I carry. A simpler way to say that is it's people pleasing at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a different type of people pleasing when you are trying to appease a man that holds power over how much you earn, how much you grow, how quickly you grow, and what your career development and movement looks like. That quote really resonated with me. And it reminded me of the time when I was working within a really toxic workplace. But I remember sitting across from my boss at the time. I had gone into the office and I had that week been followed home by someone from work. And then also I was followed to the office the following day. And I went in saying I was really frustrated and a little bit flustered because I kept having these experiences with men harassing me, both on my commute to and from work. And he then went to the whiteboard in our shared office space. He took out a Sharpie and he basically drew a mountain on a whiteboard. And I was like, what's going on here? He's like, I can tell you and explain to you why this is happening to you. And I was like, really? Okay, tell me more. And as I sat there with a perplexed smile on my face, because I didn't want him to know that I thought he was being a fucking jackass, he put a number 1 at the bottom of one side of the mountain, a 10 on the opposite side, and a 5 at the point. And he told me that I fell around the top end of that range. And the reason why I was experiencing such a high volume of harassment was because I am average in the looks department. And if I was a zero, no one would be interested in speaking to me. But if I was a 10, that'd be too intimidating. And he said this to me in front of someone that reported to me at the time. And I didn't push back. I didn't say this is inappropriate. I smiled and I laughed.
Well, it's fight, flight, or freeze, right? But also, wow, toxic asshole theories aside, he used company property to do this? He used company whiteboard? Company Sharpie?
Yes. Company Sharpie, company whiteboard, and company time.
Yes. So time theft, supply theft, all the theft.
The time. It was a long time. I remember sitting there for about an hour listening to him explain to me this whole thing. The way I described it was what, a couple minutes? This was a much longer experience for me, or at least it felt that way. And the man that reported into me, who was in that room at the time, he felt so uncomfortable by it. He actually got up and walked away, which, I mean, the intervention wasn't hitting the way it could have, but he didn't stand for it, which I think I appreciated at the time.
But the problem is these systems are so big that even with Amazon, this bombshell New York Times article comes out and no one speaks up at Amazon to really publicly acknowledge it and say, yes, I witnessed this. Nobody goes on the record. And it takes so much of that work to dismantle these huge companies. And if an article like that doesn't take down the company, then it just creates this cycle of toxic hopelessness. And then, like, it's what Christy chose to do. At some point, you opt out. At some point, you just choose to channel your energy and your talent into something else rather than continuing to fight against a system that's just going to put up walls around you.
Yeah, I really appreciated the conversation and I really valued Christy's vulnerability. I think that it's a really brave thing that she did to toe up with Amazon, which is arguably one of the most successful companies in the world. I don't think a lot of people would do it. A lot of people aren't even co-signing or in support of her book publicly because they're afraid of the backlash that they may be on the receiving end of. So kudos to Christy. And then to anyone that's listening or listens to this episode, if it does inspire you to share your own experiences, even if it's just with a friend or a family member, we really hope you do. There's a lot of power that comes from speaking about the experiences that you have at work.
I do think books like this are doing their part and making a difference. So with that, let's get into the episode.
Christy, welcome to Girl Boss Radio. I am so excited to kick off this conversation. First and foremost, how are you feeling today?
I'm good. We actually have some sun in the sky in Seattle, which is not a given in February. So I'm really happy about that. It's blue.
Yeah, it's sunny today. I'm actually coming back from a four-week trip in Iceland where I read your book. I absolutely loved your book. I think that anyone that's worked in any corporate environment or just worked in general could relate to a lot of parts of it, specifically as women. And when I was reading Exit Interview, The Life and Death of My Ambitious Career, it brought up a lot of emotions for me as my own experiences working in corporate environments. Specifically, a lot of people don't know this, but one of the reasons why I became an entrepreneur was because I had experienced a workplace assault. And then jumped from that workplace to another where I'd experienced bullying. And since then, I've literally only worked for myself.
Wow. I mean, it makes absolute sense. The amount of drama that women experience in the workplace. I mean, we all do, men and women, but the amount of like high drama that women can go through and trauma, just incredible.
Oh, absolutely. I was diagnosed not too long ago with having PTSD from workplace specific experiences. So it's been something that I've been trying to work through and counseling that I've been getting specifically with trauma-informed therapists. But I know it's not something that I'm alone in experiencing. And when I was reading your book, although there were some parts that were really hard to move through, I felt a little less alone in those experiences because what you were so brave in sharing.
Thank you. It's actually made me feel less alone having written it. I felt kind of alone when I was writing it, and it took almost 4 years. But I've heard from so many women and men too, for that matter. When the book came out, I thought, well, maybe it was just me who felt this way. And now I'm like, nope, it's very clear that my experience is not even that unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. So your book captures the 12 years that you spent working at Amazon. And I'm curious, why write a book about your experience at Amazon?
I kicked it around for a while. I mean, the glib answer is that I didn't get an exit interview when I left Amazon. And I had things to say after 12 years as one of relatively few women in leadership. I also started reflecting on my time there and realizing it's not just any workplace. It was a crazy place to be during a period of wild growth. It's the most, maybe the most controversial company in the world. And so I thought I could just give them a little peek from one person's point of view. I'd seen a lot of reporting on Amazon in books, and some of it was correct and some of it was off base. And I thought, let's just say what it was like to be there. And I also wanted to give women who work in offices a feeling that they're not crazy.
And do you think that people that are still at Amazon that maybe were there during your time, maybe even Jeff Bezos, who knows, do you think that they've read your book?
I know they have. I mean, I don't know about Jeff Bezos. I don't know if I want Jeff to read my book or not. Sort of frightening. I have heard from hundreds and hundreds of Amazon employees in countries where I didn't even know Amazon had an office. So I know they're all reading my book. And I was told that someone said every VP in the company is reading your book right now. And I heard from some of those VPs, you know, who reached out to say, I love your book. I can't say this publicly, as I'm sure you understand. It's great. So it's definitely made the rounds. Women, I was told, are actually passing around physical copies of it with notes to each other, almost like a yearbook.
Neat.
Yeah. That gave me chills. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Now knowing that context, this is like the ultimate Glassdoor review that you've left.
It is kind of. You never know if a book is going to be successful or not. So I didn't really anticipate any of that, but it happened. Yeah.
And I love the title, The Life and Death of My Ambitious Career. What do you think is happening to ambitious women in the world of work right now?
I do think they are in some ways having the ambition beaten out of them. I think about politicians like Hillary Clinton, where there was data showing that when she's in a job, the public loves her. They're happy with how she's doing. They really like her. But when she's asking for a job, her poll numbers crater because people didn't like the idea that she wanted the power, that she was asking for the power. That really resonated with me. And I see that a lot, you know, that you're not supposed to grasp for the power. And so women are taught that ambition is ugly, that it's girl bossy in the worst way. I actually feel like I outgrew Amazon, which sounds like an arrogant thing to say about the world's largest company, but my ambition could not thrive there. They did not want me to be ambitious in the way that I wanted to. And I thought, well, to really let my ambition thrive, I have to leave this place.
Yeah. And there's a part in the book and a part of your story there where you are at this point having worked towards a promotion for years, and then they change your reporting structure into someone who is literally at the exact same level as you are. And you brought this to his attention to say, well, if I'm reporting into someone that is the same level as me, they can't promote me. And he was like, no, they can. And you're like, no, they can't. How did that hinder your growth there?
Amazon is chaos. That's one thing people don't really understand about Amazon, that it's so large that huge swaths of it are just madness at this point. This manager in particular, that was shocking because I had had a really good relationship with him. But at the time, I just thought, I've been forgotten. And he's not even stopped to think about the practical impact on me. I had to actually explain, yeah, a level 7 can't promote a level 7 to level 8. Which is true of, I think, every corporation in the world, pretty much. But he just didn't understand. And so the outcome was that I just felt like someone who didn't matter even to my manager. And if you don't matter to your manager, you got to go, because that's the person who makes or breaks your future.
One quote that really stood out to me, and as well as Liz, who read your book as well, who's the GM at Girl Boss, and I'm just going to read it out. You wrote, "If you can't outrun your gender, you might as well live as you please. It might be the freedom of the truly fucked, but I suggest you take it." What were you trying to communicate when you said that? I loved it.
I love it. I love it too. It's this idea that I've been thinking about for a long time. There's no right way to be a woman, is what I figured out. You're always doing it wrong. And so it's almost this beaten down kind of freedom where you think, well, if I can't do it right, no matter what, then I might as well just do what I want to do, knowing that in some way I'm always going to be losing a little bit, but maybe I can win something also. I came to this realization toward the end of my Amazon career when I was in a conversation with men about diversity and inclusion, where they kept going back to the old stereotypes. Well, women just don't want the big jobs. Women have different priorities. And they kept talking about women being moms over and over. And I'm not a mom. I never wanted to be a mom. And I'm standing in that room listening to them say, well, women are moms over and over, thinking like, do they think I'm a mom? do they think all women are just kind of moms in some vague way? And that was the moment I thought, you can't outrun your gender. It's always going to trail you, no matter what.
And what did that translate to in terms of your behavior when you had that realization?
I shed some illusions then, and I think I stopped playing the game in some ways of trying to get ahead. I mean, I was still, I'm kind of a good girl. Like I still, of course, acted decently at work and played by the rules overall, but I no longer thought if I just relate to these men in the exact right way, I'll get ahead. So I just relaxed a little bit. I became more myself. I got a little blunter than I had been, a little more cynical in a way that actually made me happier. I just chilled a bit. And it was really because I realized the things I wanted, I probably wasn't going to get. But I could also then start thinking, well, what are some other things you might want?
I want to play, because I listened to your audiobook and I read it as well. I usually double up just to make sure I don't miss anything. This clip from your book, I really enjoyed, and I'm going to play it for you, and I want to hear your thoughts on it.
It would feel to drop the weight of other women's self-loathing, to move around campus letting women's well-being be someone else's problem. I guess I should care, but I've given up.
In this clip, kind of explain what you were referring to and talking about in that moment. What got you to that point?
My best friend, who's Marnie in the book, at one point she said to me casually, have you ever noticed that everything meant to improve life for women at Amazon involves other women doing work for free? And I was like, oh, right. You know, all the committees, all the diversity stuff, it's just women volunteering. And I got, I think, again, in a healthy way, jaded about that. I thought, this is a closed circuit. If none of these women are in touch with the highest levels of power, there's only so much we can do. At some point, I thought, this is a waste of my time. I also found at Amazon that women's self-loathing really, really started to infect me as their manager. I had a lot of just absolutely brilliant, wonderful women who worked for me, and they all were just programmed to think that they were awful, that they were going to be fired any second. And it started to be incredibly stressful to manage people who couldn't see past that. And I beat myself up over it for so long because I love these women. I talk to a lot of them to this day, but there was nothing I could do. There was nothing I could say as their manager to convince them that they were good enough. And at some point, I went from being a manager to a principal. So leadership, but no direct reports. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me because I was able to walk away from carrying that burden of the self-loathing. I could still mentor people. I could still talk to women, but it wasn't my daily job to prop them up in a way that I didn't have to prop my men up because I don't know if the men just felt better about themselves or if they just wouldn't let it show, but it was a relief.
Yeah. For me, as someone who has been hypercritical of my personal ability to manage people, and I've been trying to explore what my management style is. And the conclusion I've come to is I don't have one because I don't want to manage people.
That's completely legit. Yep. Yep.
That's my management style. My management style is no.
Right. I'd love someone else to do it. You're a principal. Yes. There you go. Yeah.
It's so interesting because when I was reading the book, I felt like a weight lift off my shoulders as you move through those words and shared that realization. But also I was reflecting on all of the women that I know that are carrying the burden of not only propping up other women in ways that in some cases they can't, white women that are working within workplaces in leadership roles, and they're trying to empower and support Indigenous women or Black women. And they just don't have, in some cases, the experience or the language to support them in the unique way that they need it. But then also, I reflected on myself, individual contributor within companies prior, where I had my core work that I would oftentimes do for 5 to 6 hours after work because I was involved in one meeting after the other, one committee after the other, in every single employee resource group. And I was surrounded in all of those spaces by other women that were trying to make work better, not only for ourselves, but for everyone else. And it was so interesting to hear someone that was at your level in Amazon having those same experiences. Do you think there's ever an opportunity for women to escape the additional non-promotable tasks that they oftentimes take on?
I think only if you just decide to and you just do it. And you have to be comfortable with the idea that people might think you're selfish.
What are your thoughts on drinking, work, and women?
I think that drinking. I was shocked at what a part of Amazon culture it was. People had nice bottles of scotch on their desks, just sitting there. People would just stop at 5, have a drink, and they get back to work. It's all fine until someone becomes an alcoholic, which I did. I was probably destined to overdrink anyway, but Amazon really brought it out in me. And so I ended up doing half my time at Amazon sober and half as a drinker. And so I had this nice little A-B test. And what I noticed is that people really use it as self-medication. And it's not necessarily just let's get a little loose or just have some fun. There was a lot of like, well, oh God, I've got to have this drink or I can't go on. Or I've had my 6 p.m. drink and now I can get back to work, which is like, I don't know if you're making great decisions after you've been drinking either. And I think that women are encouraged to drink like men at work. It's a macho thing. We're sort of encouraged to be, oh, I'm so tough that I can put up with all kinds of shit. And as long as I get my glass of wine or 2 or 3 when I get home, it's all worth it. This is my prize. And I realized I needed prizes that went beyond just drinking this certain liquid. I needed rest. I needed real friends. I needed hobbies. And when I got alcohol out of my life, which was a very, very hard thing to do, it took me years. I made space for that stuff. The culture doesn't want women to make space for that stuff. The culture wants us to do for others and then fool ourselves that this is me time, like me with my glass of wine. But you're giving way, way, way more than you're getting back when you're drinking like that, when it's a daily thing or a habit. And I think it's just kind of playing into the hands of the patriarchy. No, I'm not saying that every woman who enjoys a drink now and then is playing in the hands of patriarchy. But if you're substituting alcohol for the things you actually need, that's right where they want you.
What does it take to build a strong, sustainable creator business? In the new podcast, Unique Genius, The Business of Creators, some of the world's top creators share the mistakes and wins from their journeys to success, helping you save time, avoid the hiccups, and move right to what works. Thinkific CEO Greg Smith is joined by high-profile creators like John Yushai, Ellie Diop, and Zaylee Barclay to answer burning questions that will help you unlock your own unique genius. Ready to jump weeks or even months ahead in your creator journey? Listen in to Unique Genius on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to My Chat with Christy. Next up, she talks about why who you pick as a partner is equally as important as where you choose to work. Let's get back into it. I don't feel jealousy often, but I did feel jealous and quite envious of your relationship with your husband that you speak a lot of in your book. And I think my question for you is specifically John, as he seemed to be an anchor for you as you navigated all the ways of your experiences at Amazon. Do you think the partner we pick has an impact on our happiness at work?
Absolutely. Especially for women, I think, because you have to have someone who can be okay with you being gone sometimes, not being as focused on things at home, not being threatened if you make more money than they do. I really won the lottery with John. You know, we met when I was 18. We started dating. It was 4 or 5 years later, but we've been together ever since. And we were both artists. We were both expected to be starving artists when we got married. And 10 years later, he's founding a software company and I'm working for a software company. I don't know that we'd ever thought of the word software when we were 26. You know, things change. And we've just always managed to kind of grow in the same direction. He was never jealous of my Amazon experience. I think partly because he had his eyes open and he could see what it was doing to me. But I was making a crazy amount of money. I probably earned quadruple what he did at one point. And he was doing fine, but I was doing really fine. The way that we look at it now is that money enabled him to launch a startup because I had money coming in every month. I had great health insurance. So it gave him that security. And now his success is allowing me to build a career as a writer. So we've always had this long view. We always say to each other, life is long and wide. There has to be room for these shifts. There has to be room for different phases of life. And you just kind of figure it out together. So I knew women whose husbands were threatened by their success. And that's a terrible place to be because it means somebody doesn't want you to be good at what you do and be recognized for it. And that's really, really painful.
Yeah. So for me, when I think about my friend Joanna, who was the first podcast episode I did, Joanna is the president and founder of a company by the name of Nyx. And she always says, when you pick a partner, you need to pick someone that's your biggest champion, that's rooting for you, that wants you to succeed.
I love what your friend said, but I can tell you that when I was 22 and met John, or 26 and married him, I did not have a thought like that in my little head. I was like, I'm going to be an artist. We're going to be poor. It's going to be fine. My ambitions really grew later. So I think I got lucky, honestly.
So what was the tipping point? What forced you to leave Amazon eventually?
So Jody Cantor of the New York Times wrote this huge article about Amazon's culture. And when it came out, there was a lot of defensiveness from men because some of it was about the gender experience. And this guy who had been at Amazon for like a year wrote a blog post about how actually it's a great company for women. And he knows this because he had a female manager once and he knows women who work there. He basically was like, it's a terrific place to be female, which is not something he could actually know with any certainty. And Jeff Bezos sent an email to the entire company, which he never does. I think it might be the only time he did it in my 12 years, saying, for another perspective, you should read this guy's blog post. And I remember I was on a run in a park by my house, and I just was like, what? How is this what you decide to highlight? He had an opportunity, Jeff Bezos, to say, well, I should be curious about what women are experiencing here and see if this is the tip of an iceberg. And instead, he said, no, this other man says it's great to be a chick here, and therefore it is. Something died inside me then. My last hope that there would ever be interest in the female experience at Amazon just kind of died. And it was a freeing moment in a way. But I think that's the moment I realized you can stay here, but why? Like, why would you bother?
Do you think Jeff Bezos cares about the experiences of women at Amazon?
I don't think he does in any real way, because he is so smart and so innovative that if he did, the women's experience would be better. I mean, he's not CEO anymore, but he would have put resources toward it. He would have come up with some idea that probably sounded crazy and turned out to be great. So if he cared, it would be different. And I think they will care when it becomes a business problem, a hiring problem, a retention problem. That's when they'll care, and not before. And it may be too late at this point.
In the book, you talk about an experience you had with a senior person at Amazon calling you stupid. How do you reflect back on that experience now?
At the time, I mean, this is a senior vice president, the third top person in the entire company. And he just basically threw a tantrum that I never will fully understand and called me stupid in a room full of other leaders. And I, at the time, was so close to crying. I was kind of in shock. I was presenting a document that had been received extremely well by the second top person in the company. And I just thought, oh, we're getting this guy's buy-in and we'll move forward. And so I was stunned and I couldn't talk because I was so close to crying. And I felt ashamed of that for many years. Like, oh, you almost cried. How embarrassing. And in hindsight, well, of course, you know, sometimes people cry in situations where they feel attacked. And I know more about my own stress responses now. And I know that when I get angry, which is what I was feeling, crying is sort of what my body wants to do. So I feel like all the shame lives with him now. It doesn't live with me. I almost wish I had just started sobbing, just because I think it would have freaked him out even more and maybe disarmed him. But I can also tell you that every person from Amazon who's read the book knew exactly who I was talking about. So that also told me, well, it wasn't just me. A lot of us went through this.
Is he still at Amazon?
No, he left a few years ago. He's still in Seattle. And you know, the thing that sucks is he's probably having a great life. He's rich. He's powerful. I'm sure he's having a nice time. And what can you do? I'm having a nice time too. So
before we wrap up the conversation, what advice do you have for listeners that are in a corporate environment who have no aspirations to be self-employed or an entrepreneur anytime soon, but they're having a challenge navigating the corporate ladder, if you will?
I think if you have a good relationship with your manager, first of all, that is the most important thing that you can have. I believe in being really explicit about these things and maybe sitting down with your manager and saying, can we talk in a really concrete way about what I should do? I want to go up the ladder. This is why, although you don't have to have a reason. and maybe say, here's where I think I'm probably already there. And here's where I think I might still have gaps. Do you agree? I think the more concrete you can be, even knowing that promotion is never about just checking boxes, but then you're making it a topic and you're making it something it's okay for the two of you to talk about rather than just, oh, I hope someone notices me and I get promoted.
And you spent a lot of time at Amazon without a promotion and were working towards it for a long time. What advice do you have to people that believe that they're doing all the right things, but they're still not getting the acknowledgement or perhaps the growth opportunities that they believe that they deserve?
I went 12 years without a promotion at Amazon, and it was perpetually, oh, you're a year away. I was a year away the whole time. I think that sometimes when you're not getting the recognition that you know you deserve, it may be that you need to be louder about what you're doing. I think women especially have a tendency to say, oh, it was the whole team, or it wasn't that hard. You need to be willing to publicize yourself a little bit more and talk about your accomplishments. Also, it sometimes has to do with having the right sponsor. You really need someone higher in the organization who believes in you, who's not just a dutiful manager or nice person, but who is like, I am going to stick this person in some challenging situations. I'm going to get them in the right meetings. I'm going to give them good feedback. And unfortunately, I don't have great advice about how to find that person. But I do think it's critically important to have someone who is going to make a project of you, basically.
So one last question for you. For the aspiring writers out there that are navigating a corporate opportunity right now or a job, and they're just dying to become a writer and get to this evolution that you have in your own career, what advice do you have for them?
I love this question because I think writers, and these are usually people who want to be creative writers, to be clear, often don't understand how good a corporation can be for them. One of my jobs at Amazon was doing the UX writing, well, all the writing for Amazon Go. So a shopping experience no one had ever navigated before, very little space to do it in. That was the hardest writing I've ever done in my life. It made me so much better at compression, at efficiency, at using words well. I had all kinds of opportunities like that. And I took them and I realized that writing a document was making me a better writer. It was all part of it. And so I encourage people who would rather be writing to look for opportunities in their corporate jobs, whether they are explicitly writing oriented or not, to hone those skills, hone your observational skills, eavesdrop on people talking for dialogue. You're in the midst of stories and drama all the time. I would also say, remember the grass is always greener. I love the life I live now. I also sometimes really miss knowing what I'm doing. You know, like I miss going to the office and just being like, oh, I know how to do this job. I need to talk to that guy. And then I'm going to go over here in this meeting and I know how to add value. There is something about stability and also making a living that is really nice. You could do worse than to have a day job and still be a writer. You do not have to write full time. I don't write full time. I mean, I get maybe 2 good writing hours a day, which is about how much time I think studies show that people do individual work in the office. So don't think of it as either or, you know, like you can build a life as a writer, whether you write for a living or not. You just have to maybe say no to some other things. I mean, I wrote my first book while working 60 hours a week at Amazon. I wrote on the weekends. I didn't do other things for 2 years on the weekends, but I got it done. And that was a building block to the life I had now. Also remember, life is a long game. I was not very smart to think that when I hadn't made it by 30, I would never make it. But it's a very young person's way of thinking. I was 48 when my first book came out. You're not actually old and dead when you're 48 or 53 or 63. Like you are fine. It's not you think it's going to be. You have time. You have time to do that.
Yeah. No, I love this. And I think that what I thought was most interesting about your career is that I'm 35 right now. You started at Amazon when you were 30.
I was about to turn 36. Yeah.
Yeah. 36. Yeah. So sometimes I feel like I'm at the end of the road when I can have a second, a third, a fourth act beyond what I'm doing now.
I took the job because I felt like I was at the end of the road. I felt so old. And now I think of the book in some ways as a coming of age story. I think I was a child of 36, you know, like all the things I didn't know. And of course, I wasn't a child. I was a full-grown adult. I thought that you stopped changing at some point. And now I understand that you never stop changing. and you don't want to.
No. Growth is good, baby. Okay. Well, I think that that is a great place to end this conversation. I want to thank you for your time and energy.
Thank you.
Your vulnerability today. I have so many more questions that I want to ask, but
I'll come back anytime.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Christy, for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap on my conversation with Christy. All I have to say is go read her book. Plus, leave a comment and let us know what we can do to make Girl Boss Radio even better. Is there a guest you think I should interview? A topic we haven't covered yet? We want to hear it. As always, this podcast is produced by Liz Goober and Victoria Christie and edited by Diego Domine. Until next time, keep blooming.